This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Communicating to them that they're powerless before this omnipotent government corporate institution does to people. It convinces them that the tiny little box in which they live is really the only box in which they want to live, so they no longer even realize they're being imprisoned. Rosa Luxemburg put that best. She said, "He who does not move does not notice his chains."
That's Glenn Greenwald on the Surveillance State on the Next Alternative Radio. The award-winning journalist and lawyer Glenn Greenwald recently broke the story of NSA contractor turned whistleblower Edward Snowden. Hear Glenn Greenwald on the Surveillance State on Alternative Radio this Tuesday at 9 a.m. on KBOO Portland.
I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are tuned to KBOO 90.7 FM here in Portland. And it's 9:01, time for the Old Mole Variety Hour. The name of this show comes from Karl Marx's image of the mole as the revolution, that force of the people that works below the surface of society to undermine its foundations and then erupts unexpectedly to challenge the old order of things. This show supports the efforts of ordinary people to get to the roots of the conditions that oppress them and to fight for radical change. I'm your host for today, Clayton Morgridge. Joe Clement is our engineer. Well, on today's show, we'll be hearing about how young people today are increasingly skeptical about one of the legs on which modern capitalism stands, consumerism, the compulsion to buy more in order to be more. We'll have an analysis from our legal moles of how the cases of Bradley Manning and Edward Snowden are alike and yet different in what they revealed and how they went about it and the conditions in which they did it. Alan Weider will be here to look back at a book that looks back at the subterranean lives of some members of the Weather Underground. And Ivan Hale will have some reflections on Bradley Manning's off and on again choice to be the Grand Marshal of the San Francisco Gay Pride Parade. If you'd like to hear this show again, or any part of it, or tell your friends about it, you can find it on the KBOO website by going to kboo.fm and typing Old Mole Variety Hour in the search box. You can also keep up with this by becoming our friend on Facebook. Well, first up today, here is the Old Mole's Bill Resnick to talk with sociologist Charles Derber about what is arguably America's state religion, offering salvation through buying and owning things, consumerism. Bill.
Before we go to that, Clayton, I need to read these two underwriting spots to let you know how KBOO receives support from the community. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Clinton Street Theater. Featuring independent and revival films, the Rocky Horror Picture Show every Saturday at midnight, as well as the monthly KBOO Movie Night. The Clinton Street Theater is located at the corner of Southeast Clinton and 26th in Portland. Schedule and information at 503-238-5588 or cstpdx.com. This program has also been made possible in part by a grant from Merrill Hurst University's new Bachelor of Arts in Media and Film Studies, where you can explore how media in all forms affect not only how we view the world, but how we shape it. You'll learn the power of media and how you can use that power to become a participant in change. Now accepting applications. Details at merrillhurst.edu/KBOO. Now, here's Bill Resnick.
Charles Derber, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you, Bill.
Charles Derber is a sociologist at Boston College. His recent books include Capitalism, Should You Buy It?, An Invitation to Political Economy, and A People's Sociology of the U.S. He has a subspecialty writing on the movements and trends in U.S. life, pointing out that fundamental values and dispositions of the U.S. people are moving in quite radical directions, and that these point to the potential or even necessity of quite radical change that's democratic, egalitarian, sustainable, that a lot of people who listen to this station would love to have happen. Charles, Tell us about this country's major religion that most people don't actually believe in, but they do, in fact, avidly and relentlessly practice. That is when they have the money. It's called consumerism. Tell us about consumerism and why young people are at least rethinking it.
Yeah, I think that's the right word. There's some evidence, partly based on my own direct experience with young people and students that I'm in regular contact with and from polls and so forth, that suggests that the so-called millennial generation, which is people between the ages of 19 or 18 and 29, are the most environmentally aware generation, which is not surprising. They are rethinking or having doubts about a consumer-based life. That doesn't mean they're rejecting it, obviously. They sleep, I note in a little piece I did on this recently, that they sleep with their iPhones next to their pillow, and they're very addicted, as most of us are, to all kinds of gadgets. But when you talk to them more, you do pick up what you said, some doubts, nagging concerns, real dissatisfaction. And I think it reflects something we might get into, which is that while we've come to think of consumption as the one realm of freedom left, you know, that you can go to the store, you can't pick the candidates you choose at the voting booth are pretty much picked for you, and you're picking, you know, Bush or Bush Light in one way or another. People feel that, well, at least we live in a free society in the sense we're free to choose what we're going to buy. And that's, I mean, we may want to get into that, that my view is that much of consumption has been coerced not only by advertising, but by the whole way the productive political and corporate system works, which is to lay out essentially a set of options for people that sort of coerces certain kinds of consumption. The most obvious example being in the 1920s when there were large public trolley systems and so forth, which were bought up by General Motors and torn up track by track, leaving people no option for getting around in Los Angeles other than driving, and the automobile industry and the construction industry persuaded the government to fund large-scale highway building and incentivized buying of cars and so forth. So what I found, just very briefly, is that when you talk to young people today about the consumer lifestyle, they have a lot of questions about it. I mean, they love computers and they love cell phones, obviously, and tweeting, and they're addicted in many ways. But
and their clothing choices, it's clear that they haven't transcended expressiveness through consumption, but that's sort of... It seems to me that's different than wanting to have three cars and a huge house and all the rest of it, which, of course, is also becoming more and more difficult to do and environmentally destructive.
Right. And in talking about their choices, I mean, the percentage of young people today who have a car and a driver's license is substantially less than it was 20 years ago. Now, some of this may be due to the recession and they just can't afford it, but if you talk to them, they say things like, well, having a lot of stuff, buying stuff, is a pain in the rear end. It creates competitive pressures they don't feel are very useful for them about whether they have the newest stuff relative to their friends. They feel it distracts from quality time with friends and family and so forth. They know it is poisoning the earth and making their future problematic. They feel that it takes them away from important concerns about what's happening in the society. They just feel sort of like their life is filled up with a lot of things that aren't very important, and they're trying to think about that. I think this is a generation, and there's a lot of polling that suggests this, that is concerned with values, and they're very aware of, particularly of environmental crises, and of course of the interrelationship of the economic crises that we're dealing with. So I would say that we have a generation that is questioning the mass religion of consumption. I don't think they've come up with clear alternatives. It's a minority of young people who are radically shifting consumer habits. But all great social change happens with relatively small numbers of people catalyzing new ways of thinking and new ways of living. So I think we're seeing enough of a set of questions about this. If you had asked me, Bill, 10 years ago, is consumption something that could change in the United States? It's such a part of, as you were saying, such a deep religion in the United States. I would say, you know, you're just going to waste your time trying to think about ways of fundamentally altering people's addiction to consumption and so forth. And now I think, both because of economic constraints, because of the environmental concerns, and just a new kind of consciousness about these things, there's at least a conversation to be had. That's very, very important, because nothing is going to solve the environmental crisis if we don't change mass consumer. We cannot have globally or in the United States a mass consumer society and continue to have a civil society that's going to be sustainable.
This is KBOO Radio 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking to Charles Derber, who catalogs changes in American life, sometimes hard to see for others. It's refreshing, though, to have somebody who sees some light in the darkness. We've been talking about consumerism and the rethinking of consumerism, particularly by today's youth. Charles, you pointed out that sometimes great social changes begin with relatively small groups, not majoritarians for sure, where they begin thinking about how the future has to be and what different futures are possible. I think that those ideas then begin catching fire when people begin recognizing that the old system just isn't working. Do you see that happening in U.S. life? My sense is that one of the reasons that so many kids are sort of dubious about a house in the suburbs and the rest is many of them have lived in that, especially college students that were there relatively affluent, but going down and declining. And they see that their families often are in trouble and not happy. And the more things that they acquire, the less rich and vital life is. This is really one of the first generations that has come out of the shadow of abject want, which really was characterized the U.S. until 50 years ago for most people. It seems to me that that change is partly the recognition that it's not much of a life to just to keep buying things.
I think so. I mean, I think that you got a sort of early, if this is a kind of a consumer spring, you know, like the Arab Spring, a kind of spring of new awareness about how people are living. I think in the 1960s, a lot of the students who were from privileged backgrounds were beginning to raise questions about the affluence of their own lifestyle. And in fact, the real affluence that they had gave them a lot more freedom to do so. Today, it's complicated because I think you're right. Certainly most of the students that I work with, I teach at Boston College, come from relatively well-to-do families. But those families are starting to have trouble, both the parents and the children. The kids are locked into debt and the parents are losing their jobs or facing uncertain retirements and so forth. So I think the kids, on the one hand, have had the experience you say. They've seen the suburban, consumer-based, mall-based lifestyle, and it's not all that it's cracked up to be. And on the other hand, they're facing real constraints economically in terms of the job market, in terms of the debt they're carrying, and their parents' threats to their parents' well-being. So they don't have quite the freedom that my generation did at that age to experiment and to sort of challenge things in a more drastic way. And that's why I think it's very, very hard to predict how this pattern is going to play itself out, because there are very contradictory forces at work in the lives of young people. On the one hand, they're quite idealistic. They're very aware, particularly of environmental issues, which have gone very mainstream. This is not a radical issue anymore. But their feelings, when you try to move toward more systemic ways of thinking about it and down to the level of how they're going to live, their choices are quite limited. You know, they feel boxed in by all kinds of economic problems and questions that they just haven't been able to resolve. So I'm not trying to make a prediction here. I do feel like the challenge to the life of mass consumption has started, but we're very early in the journey and we don't have a hell of a lot of time to work our way through it because the environmental pressures are just too urgent. I think the failure of the Obama administration to carry forward any major climate campaign is the most disappointing, the most catastrophic aspect of the Obama presidency, because he really ran in 2008 on green jobs and the idea of really trying to create a national conversation about the meaning of environmental change and tying it to the problems in the economy. And he really punted on that. He did not follow through. The one area where he did choose relatively good advisors was in the energy area, and they didn't really assert themselves. And now it's so impossible to address these issues in Congress. He's doing a few things by executive order and so forth. But for this to scale up, as you said, large change often starts to happen in small niches in the society. But my view is that for it to scale up, you need to have national and global dynamics. You know, the fact that we just passed a 400 parts per million of the CO2 footprint, I think, has raised public alarm. The fight around the Keystone pipeline, so forth. You're seeing fairly large-scale coalitions of labor groups, including mainstream, AFL-CIO, with environmental groups. That's really quite important, I think. If you can get workers and labor groups aligned with environmental and climate groups, that's major progress. So I don't know where it's going to go, but I know the conversation has been opened up, and I think it's most tangible, interestingly, in food and agriculture. You'd be amazed at the number of people in urban universities. You had this, of course, originally in the land-grant public universities. I grew up at the University of Illinois, where it was an agricultural setting, and there were large farms and agricultural programs all over campus. But now, in urban universities all over the country, and in urban environments and lower-income settings, you're seeing people changing their idea of what it means to consume food. They're growing their own. We at my campus, Boston College, which is very urban, there are growing numbers of plots of land where students are growing food together. They have created by themselves a cafeteria, which is all locally sourced food. Food is such an intimate relation to what you're putting into your body. I suspect that food consumption may be an important area where people's thinking about these issues begin to change. And then I think if you tie that to bicycles and transit issues and to heating and cooling issues and the way people are living, as you said, sort of there's a documented trend of people moving away from suburbs into the cities. Sort of like more the European style, you know, where the jobs and the desirable locations are living in cities, in apartments, rather than in spread out exurbia or suburbia. These are also lifestyle trends that are important. They're being documented, and they're hopeful from an environmental point of view.
This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here talking to Charles Derber. We started with consumerism. We're really talking now about the absolute necessity of changing this country and, in fact, the world and the way we produce and consume all over the planet towards environmentally sustainable ways. Charles, it seems to me that these struggles against consumerism and the struggles towards a sort of more locally based economy that uses much less energy and that is far closer to the land and that conserves, those values are increasing, and the practices around them are, even recycling of various kinds, are becoming better known, and the necessity for them is becoming better known. A lot of people, though, are doing it as sort of a personal mission. They consume less, they recycle, drive less, they would buy an electric car if they had the money. On the other hand, that certainly won't be sufficient. And I think we have to sort of begin thinking about sort of national policies that Obama has sort of touched on but avoided actually trying to provide any leadership. How do you see that playing out, especially as the environmental crisis becomes more severe? People are going to have to start thinking about that.
Well, I really agree with what you said, Bill, that it's very important that small movements on a local scale begin and they make the experience real for people and open them up to the larger conversation. But I also strongly agree that they can fizzle out if they're not connected to large national conversations and policy changes. So we need, obviously, massive changes in public policy, whether we're talking about agriculture and agricultural subsidies and getting rid of the whole subsidization of unsustainable monoculture production, industrial agriculture, to the whole transit system. We need a massive investment in public transit infrastructure and a massive effort to invest, as say Bloomberg and the mayor of New York, as you're seeing at local levels, in alternative forms of transportation, bicycles and zip car sharing, the whole share economy model that you see in Europe a lot.
Let me add just one other one, interject. Sure. We need a new system of sustainable and clean energy. Coal plants producing electricity or any of the carbon plants have to be shut down. We have to move towards sun. Those are tremendous investments, and they're all quite possible. The technologies are there.
You probably saw, Bill, that there's a new film out about Hannah Arendt, who is the wrote this famous book after she saw the trial of Eichmann in Jerusalem, about the banality of evil. And, you know, she was struck by this man who was just, quote, doing his job, which happened to be exterminating millions and millions of people. And, you know, in a sense, that's what these big power companies, I mean, the big oil and big coal companies, are playing an absolutely genocidal role in the world today. They are preventing the transformation you just suggested, which is absolutely essential. And I thought of Hannah Arendt because, you know, there's a kind of sense of which, well, these people are just doing their job. You know, Exxon is the most profitable company in the world in terms of quarterly profits, and they know they can make massive amounts of money at the expense of our future, and they're happy to do so. And there's a certain banality about it, but you couldn't have a more evil. I've made the argument that the energy company should be made into public utilities. They should be, I mean, we have plenty of experience of that. Roosevelt did that with the TVA. Not that that's an ideal form today, but energy companies are largely subsidized by the government and by the taxpayers. The issues are so central. I mean, the transformation and the creation of alternative energy sources is so enormously important that I think if you're going to bail out with public money and take over the auto companies, as you did briefly, and the banks in 2008, then we ought to be nationalizing these companies and making public priorities about moving extremely rapidly toward clean energy production. All of that has to be accompanied with what we started with, which is a shift in people's options for how they live. You know, it's important to remember that 100 years ago, people in cities grew much of their own food, made much of their own clothes. Consumption was produced. It was created. It was manufactured by large-scale companies that couldn't exist if people didn't buy their products. And so they had to take, in the late 19th century, they had to take a population, I think you were alluding to this earlier, which was accustomed, I mean, there was no such thing as mass consumerism. And they systematically built the mass consumer society. And they did so, even though we think of consumption as an area of freedom, they did it by taking people's choices away, as in the case of the auto industry, which took away public transit, basically destroyed it by structuring the environment in ways that it's almost impossible not to be a consumer. And so this requires, as you said, national policy choice. It took national policy choices to build the interstate highways, to build the automobile industry to what it is, to construct the suburban landscape that's been created since World War II. It's going to take another set of major public policy decisions. This seems outlandish in the current environment. It seems impossible. But it's going to grow as the price of fossil fuels inevitably gets higher and as the costs environmentally become more obvious with, you know, much more drastic changes in people's lives. So I don't know. I think we're up against it. You know, I think the calculations of whether this large, seismic, cultural and political change can be made in the time frame that we have available to us is a big question. But we have no choice but to try to make that change as large as possible, as fast as possible.
I think I'm going to steal the last word, which will require both creating models for doing that as well as movements that have the capacity in American life to grow very rapidly when people begin realizing that the old system is bankrupt and has to be replaced, which may not give us many years for experimentation.
It can happen very quickly, Bill. Just to add an addendum to what you said, I agree with you. But, you know, things that people never anticipate can explode. I mean, you think of the Arab Spring. Things that people never anticipated can make massive transformations happen very quickly.
Charles Derber, thanks a lot for talking to us today.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
Right. So long.
Bye-bye.
And that's Madonna, the Material Girl, following up on the discussion of consumerism by Charles Derber and Bill Resnick. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour here on KBOO. I'm Clayton Morgridge. Coming up later in the hour, we'll be hearing from Ivan Hale about the Gay Pride Parade in San Francisco and from Alan Weider about a family of the Weathermen Underground. But right now, Jan Hocken and attorney Mike Snedeker are here with another in the series, The Left and the Law, today discussing the situations of people who expose secret government surveillance that appears to be unconstitutional. Jan.
Well, the case of Edward Snowden and the leaking of government secrets trumped this week the fate of his fellow whistleblower, Bradley Manning, currently on trial. So, Mike, let's talk about the commonalities and differences of these two cases, but I'd like to begin with a comment from one of the pundits this week in comparing them and their political profiles. With Bradley Manning, you almost wonder if he even really had a plan to what he was going to do if he got caught, when he got caught, what exactly was his end game. With Snowden, we know actually he's giving these interviews from Hong Kong. He's probably going to face the music at some point one way or another, but he was, again, more deliberative about what he leaked and seems to have had a plan. Well, we Americans like a plan. So what do you see in these comparisons, Mike? And maybe we could start with what they actually did, as well as the plans the government has for these two cases.
Well, what Bradley Manning did was quite specific in that he revealed, for example, the Iraqi war logs, State Department cables about Tunisia and the Tunisian government that had really concrete effects in the whole world. The Iraqi people...
We're going to have to change mics here. Mike?
Okay,
hold that thought. We're going to... So we had a few technical problems here, and this is Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker on with The Left and the Law talking about comparisons between the Bradley Manning and Edward Snowden case. And you were describing... Mike, say again, give us a little summary of what these cases represent.
Well, Snowden's revelations are profound and nebulous in that they are going to affect everybody and their own consideration of how we live. They make it clear that the surveillance state is a joint effort of the government and of private industry, that even when private industry does not want to cooperate with the government, there are legal procedures. For example, Yahoo tried to employ them and resist, but they lost in a court case that we find out about through Snowden years later. It's like living in a panopticon where every move we make is known. And that it used to be that total information was no information, really. If you got pictures of everybody, you have pictures of nobody. But now they've got sorting software. They have ways of developing patterns. For example, David Petraeus, the general, was outed because of metadata analysis of his emails that mean that transparency is a fact of life.
We never did learn about the guilty party in outing Petraeus and what...
Well, his sexual adventures were so much more livelier and more interesting that that never came up.
Then the geek, presumably the geek, the malcontent, the frustrated bureaucrat who outed him, right? But now that whole profile of the young malcontent is very much on trial here. These young men who are thought to have carried out reckless acts against the government.
Well, Manning's revelations were devastatingly concrete. His Apache war logs, a video of Americans in a helicopter shooting people and joking about it was a mediagenic event that's spread like wildfire all over the world. Our Iraqi activities of killing people, then bombing the place, but not until the Iraqis had learned that the victims had been all shot in the head, led specifically to Iraqis' refusal to allow the U.S. to have immunity from lawsuits, which essentially got us out of that war. There have been profound impacts in Tunisia. The whole Arab Spring was in, took off from the revelations in State Department cables about how corrupt and much in the pocket were the leaders of Tunisia at that time. So Bradley Manning's revelations have been remarkably specific. He showed, for example, that in Haiti, the Haitian government effort to raise the minimum wage was frustrated by our State Department working closely with Haynes, Fruit of the Loom, and Levi Strauss because they didn't want to jack up the minimum wage. That is a sort of State Department activity that we do regularly on a daily basis, supporting oppressive regimes all over the world, that the details of which are horribly embarrassing, and they make it clear the extent to which our government is not working in the interests of democracy. So Branning, you want to know why Snowden has a plan. Bradley Manning has been tortured, isolated, and is now being subjected to a show trial that Snowden surely was aware of when he decided what and how to do what he did.
So this claim, and Daniel Ellsberg has made the same point in defending Snowden's decision to leave the country. He said after the Pentagon Papers were released, he did post bail and he was able to talk about his case. And the situation of Bradley Manning now is quite soberingly different.
He's being court-martialed in Fort Meade, Maryland. Fort Meade is the center and has been for many decades of all intelligence gathering. His court-martial, the government plans on calling 128 witnesses. They've set it up in two courtrooms, the interior courtroom where the witnesses will appear, the exterior courtroom where hand-selected media members will be allowed to appear. Over 80% of the media requests to attend have been denied, and the two courtrooms can be severed with the click of a switch. There's very little legal drama on in terms of what happened. Manning has acknowledged what happened, when he did it, and what he did. The trial will all be about his intent. He's got a lot of charges related to just revealing classified information, which he's essentially pled guilty to. But he's also facing two serious charges. One, an espionage charge from a law in 1917, passed then, that had nothing like whistleblowers in mind, and that Obama's administration has used six times more than everyone else in American history to persecute whistleblowers. The other is an act of treason under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, aiding the enemy, with its potentially a capital offense. So the whole issue will be his intent. And the government's case on this ground is remarkably weak. All the contemporaneous information we have about Bradley Manning's intent was that he wasn't trying to sell this information. He wasn't trying to hurt America. He was trying to make people aware of what we were doing. He was trying to make people know what the government supposedly acting in their name was doing in their name.
Is there potential during the trial and the coverage of the trial to, in a sense, kill the message and trying the messenger? Because these trials involve, of course, an intense scrutiny of his motivations, which, of course, are very relevant legally, but also the minutiae of the trial and the whole question of the security of leaks and that's one of the areas of commentary is how both Snowden and Manning were able to, as relatively unsenior people in their areas, one in the military and one working for a private contractor, were able to access this kind of material and download it. Is there some potential for the broader issue of the power of the state, which seems to be the important thing on trial here, rather than simply the motivations of Manning himself?
Of course, the government wants to focus all attention on the messenger, on his personal foibles, on the techniques by which he got the revelations, and to take all attention away from what he's showing.
And to make and initiate reforms or oversight at that level, to tighten the leaky ship of state.
Yeah. I mean, they have not been able to come up with one single instance of any harm that actually flowed from any of his revelations.
How important is that to the trial itself?
Well, I think it's devastating to their case. I mean, they say he's aiding the enemy now. They're saying that Al-Qaeda had access to the Internet, and therefore, because they had access to the Internet, they had access to his leaks. That's like saying that Nike is should be tried as well because Al-Qaeda had access to ordering tennis shoes on the Internet.
I think that's a better case. Let's put Nike on trial.
They have no harm. They've not been able to come up with a single instance. A couple of diplomats lost their job after the State Department cables were released. They've got all his contemporaneous statements were solid in terms of his motivation. And Bradley Manning has been steeled by the fire. I mean, he was tortured in ways that Soviets were in psychiatric hospitals. He was kept naked, woken up every 5 minutes to ask whether or not he was okay under supposedly treatment, which is always the justification for the most cruel form of treatment, of doing something for his own good. They essentially tortured him, left him without clothes, humiliated him for months.
Isn't that similar to an example of the broader dynamic of sending a message to other potential whistleblowers?
Well, that's why Snowden had a plan. I mean, his plan was to go wide, you know, to not try to hide out or to avoid it, but rather be as public as possible so that nobody could sneak into his room and cut his throat.
And then there is perhaps a political aspect to this distinction in terms of the potential impact and whether the silencing and the trial of Manning also reveals the brutality of the state. And even though he can't speak, there is a sizable level of support for him as well.
Well, there should be a much larger one. I mean, I think he gave a really moving statement in his opening statement, and there are some really gutsy, alert people who are like transcribing every part of the trial because they will not allow the a formal transcript to be released. And there are people who are very gutsy and who are working hard to publicize what he's done and to publicize what's going on in the trial. And the defense has scored many good points. And I think there is an opportunity for this to backfire, for him to rise up above the intense pressure, hostility, and maltreatment he's been subjected to and become a larger and larger figure. And that would depend on people supporting him, people rallying to the Bradley Manning Support Network, people showing up. Every Monday morning, there are people showing up from 7 a.m. to 8:30 at the gates of Fort Meade. These kinds of political activities and support, letting him know that he is not alone and letting the people know we're working for him and with him, that they're supported too, is, I think, one of the most important political activities we can engage in these days.
And so we'll continue to do what we can on that front here at KBOO. Thanks, Mike. This is Jan Hawken and Mike Snedeker talking today about the comparison of the Edward Snowden and Bradley Manning cases, and we'll there's certainly more to be covered on that front.
It's a mystery to me. The game commences for the usual fee, plus expenses, confidential information. It's in a diary. This is my investigation. It's not a public inquiry.
Private Investigation by Dire Straits here on the Old Mole Variety Hour. And before that, we heard Mike Snedeker and Jan Hawken investigating whistleblowers in the intelligence business. In a few minutes, we'll be hearing from Alan Weider about a family involved in the Weather Underground. Stay tuned to KBOO. Air Cascadia is off today. Instead, at 10, we'll hear an update on the Iranian elections. At 10:15, we'll hear Locus Focus with host Barbara Bernstein. Today's guest is Julia DeGraw, Northwest organizer for Food and Water Watch, one of several organizations closely monitoring and protesting the imminent approval of genetically engineered salmon by the FDA. At 11, it's Health and Healthcare Forum with host Roberta Hall. Today's theme is Nutrition 2013. Our guest, Dr. Melinda Menor, professor of nutrition and exercise sciences at Oregon State University. They'll talk about energy balance research. And then they'll visit the Linus Pauling Institute and hear from four participants a public presentation at the Pauling Institute, which does research and teaching on nutrition. Okay, right now, here is Ivan Hale to read from Glenn Greenwald's piece on the difficulties the organizers of the San Francisco Gay Pride March had in choosing a grand marshal. Ivan.
Thanks, Clayton. Good morning. The article I'm going to read today is from the April 27th, 2013 edition of the Guardian newspaper, and like Clayton said, it's by Glenn Greenwald. With Portland Gay Pride Parade happening yesterday, and with many of the corporate sponsors listed in this article represented, including a massive turnout by Nike, and the current trial of Bradley Manning underway, I felt the article worth revisiting today. I've edited it for brevity. In April of this year, Bradley Manning, widely known to be gay, was selected by the LGBT Pride Celebration Committee to be one of the grand marshals of the annual San Francisco Gay Pride Parade. When the backlash predictable backlash instantly ensued, the president of the board of San Francisco Pride, Lisa Williams, quickly capitulated, issuing a cowardly, imperious statement that has to be read to be believed. Williams proclaimed that, quote, Manning will not be a grand marshal in this year's San Francisco Pride celebration, end quote, and termed his selection a mistake. She blamed it all on a, quote, staff person who prematurely made the announcement based on a preliminary vote, and she assures us that all the culprit, quote, has been disciplined. She then accuses Manning of, quote, actions which placed in harm's way the lives of our men and women in uniform, end quote. A substance-free falsehood originally spread by the top U.S. military officials, which has since been decisively and extensively debunked, even by some government officials. Indeed, it's the U.S. government itself, not Manning, that is guilty of, quote, actions which placed in harm's way the lives of our men and women in uniform. And then, in my favorite part of her statement, Williams decreed that all organization members that even a hint of support for Manning's actions, even the hint, will not be tolerated by the leadership of San Francisco Pride. So let's just consider a few points raised by all of this. First, while even a hint of support for Manning will not be tolerated, there is a long roster of large corporations serving as the event's sponsors who are welcomed with open arms. It includes AT&T and Verizon, the telecom giants that enabled the illegal warrantless eavesdropping on U.S. citizens by the Bush administration and its NSA, only to get retroactively immunized from Congress and thus shielded from all criminal and civil liability. The list of San Francisco Pride sponsors also includes Bank of America, now being sued for $1 billion by the U.S. government for allegedly engaging in a systematic scheme of mortgage fraud, which the attorney, U.S. Attorney General called spectacularly brazen in scope. Another beloved San Francisco Pride sponsor, Wells Fargo, is also being sued by the U.S. for hundreds of millions of dollars in damages over claims the bank made reckless mortgage loans that caused losses for a federal insurance program when they defaulted. Also in good standing with the San Francisco Pride Board, Clear Channel, the media outlet owned by Bain Capital that broadcasts the radio programs of Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity, and Glenn Beck. So, what we see here is how the largest and most corrupt corporations own not just the government, but also the culture. Even at the San Francisco Gay Pride, the minute something even a bit deviant takes place, as defined by the standards imposed by America's political and corporate class, they must scamper, capitulate, apologize, and take an oath of fealty to their orthodoxies. We adore the military, the state, and your laws. And, as usual, the largest corporate factions are completely exempt from the strictures and standards applied to the marginalized and powerless. Second, the authoritarian state and military revering mentality pervading Williams' statement is striking, the worst of which is the mindless embrace of the baseless claims of the U.S. military officials that Manning, quote, placed in harm's way the lives of our men and women in uniform, along with the supremely authoritarian view that any actions barred by the state are ignoble and wrong. Conduct can be illegal and yet still be noble and commendable. See, for instance, Daniel Ellsberg or most of the leaders of the civil rights movement in the U.S. Equating illegal behavior with ignominious behavior is the defining mentality of an authoritarian, and is particularly notable coming from what was once viewed as a bastion of liberal dissent. Not surprisingly, Lisa Williams, according to her biography, quote, organized satellite offices for the Obama campaign and also works for various Democratic politicians. It was President Obama, of course, who so notoriously decreed Bradley Manning guilty in public before his trial even began and whose administration was found by the UN's top torture investigator to have abused him and is now so harshly persecuting him. It's anything but surprising that a person who was a loyal Obama campaign aide finds Bradley Manning anathema while adoring big corporations and banks which funded the Obama campaign and who, in the case of telecoms, Obama voted to immunize. What we see here is how even the most liberal precincts in America are now the leading spokespeople for and loyalists to state power as a result of their loyalty to President Obama. Third, when I wrote several weeks ago about the remarkable shift in public opinion on gay equality, I noted that this development is less significant than it seems because the cause of gay equality poses no real threat to elite factions or to how political and economic power in the U.S. are distributed. If anything, it bolsters those power structures because it completely and harmlessly assimilates a previously excluded group into existing institutions and thus incentivizes them to accommodate those institutions and adopt their mindset. This event illustrates exactly what I meant. While some of the nation's most corrupt corporations are welcome to fly their flag over the parade, consider what Manning, for whom even a hint of support will not be tolerated, actually did. His leak revealed all sorts of corruption, deceit, and illegality on the part of the world's most powerful corporations. His leaks have been credited with helping to spark the Arab Spring, the greatest democratic revolution the world has seen in decades. Multiple media accounts describe how the cables documenting atrocities committed by U.S. troops in Iraq prevented the Maliki government from allowing U.S. troops to stay beyond the agreed-to deadline, i.e., helping end the Iraq war by thwarting Obama's attempts to prolong it. And now, the San Francisco Gay Pride Parade is owned by and beholden to the nation's largest corporations and subject to their dictates. Those who run the event are functionaries of, loyalists to, the nation's most powerful political officials. That's how this parade was so seamlessly transformed from orthodoxy challenging, individualistic, and creative cultural icon into yet another pile of obedient apparatchiks that spout banal slogans doled out by the state while viciously scorning those who challenge them. Yes, there will undoubtedly still be exotically dressed drag queens, lesbian motorcycle clubs, and groups profoundly defined by their unusual sexual proclivities participating in the parade. But they'll be marching under a Bank of America banner and behind flag-waving fans of the national security state, the U.S. president, and the political party that dominates American politics and its political and military institutions. Yet another edgy, interesting, creative, independent event has been degraded and neutered into a meek and subservient ritual that must pay homage to the nation's most powerful entities and at all costs avoid offending them in any way. And I'm telling you, folks, when gay pride starts becoming a banner for corporate sponsorship, when marriage and military become the rally cries for equality, it's time to let your freak flag fly, because it's just a matter of time before some married gay soldier comes marching in to shut you down. The Old Mole Variety Hour. This has been Ivan Hale.
Thank you, Ivan. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour here on KBOO. And now, here is Alan Weider to review a book about one family's life in the weather underground.
Today I'm going to review a radical line from the labor movement to the weather underground, One Family's Century of Conscience. And let me say, it's a retro review. Reading Neil Gordon's novel and then viewing Robert Redford's film, The Company You Keep, a fictitious portrayal of the Weather Underground organization, led me to reread Ty Jones' book on his family, his mom and dad, WUO people, Eleanor Stein and Jeff Jones, as well as their parents, Albert Jones, a Quaker and Second World War conscientious objector, and Annie and Arthur Stein, labor movement people and both members of the Communist Party. While I actually liked Redford's film and the book even more, A Radical Line is much more encompassing as it portrays generations and real lives in the continuing struggle for a democratic socialist America. I had no intentions of writing a review as I began to reread A Radical Line. The story, though, is so engrossing, and Ty Jones' combination of detail, thoughtfulness, and drama pull you in as words bring depth to his extended family as well as collective progressive struggle in the United States. Jones's craft as a writer combined with depth of story are poignant in the first two pages of the book as he describes his parents' arrest through reflections of his own memories of the event as a four-year-old child. Throughout A Radical Line, the progressive fights of Ty Jones's extended families, Weather Underground and earlier, are connected to the collective struggle against class disparity, racism, and the Vietnam War. Jeff Jones was raised in Southern California, and as already noted, his father was a pacifist. Albert Jones's experience working as a conscientious objector at Civilian Public Service Camp No. 37 is itself a story. His path was not easy, as his father disapproved and church people at the Methodist congregation that nurtured his views abandoned him. Camp No. 37 became home. Jeff Jones' early lessons were pacifism and peace, not a long leap to the civil rights movement and opposing the war in Vietnam. Eleanor Stein's parents were much more political. Annie was introduced to socialism in high school and was politicized even further as a student at Hunter College. Ty Jones describes her early participation in the National Student League and the Communist Party. It was Annie who politicized Arthur. Initially, she was disheartened because her husband was apolitical, but she began leaving copies of the Daily Worker out at their apartment, and soon Arthur was attending meetings and demonstrations. Like Albert Jones's lifelong commitment to nonviolence, Annie and Arthur Stein never stopped fighting class disparity and racism. Ty Jones is much more descriptive of their lives than I can be in this short review. He quotes Albert's assertion to Jeff before the days of rage, quote, "Son, I believe very strongly in your goals, but if you set out to hurt somebody, I would hope and pray that you are hurt first." Concurrently, Eleanor was clearly nurtured by Annie's work in education and the civil rights movement. She was also nurtured by her father's labor activism, his founding of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee chapter in Brooklyn, and his appearance before the House Un-American Activities Committee, where he was represented by Victor Rabinowitz, the attorney who also represented Paul Robeson and Pete Seeger. The heart of A Radical Line, however, is Jeff and Eleanor's lives in SDS and the Weather Underground, and their coming together as a couple. There are rich photographs in the center of the book, especially one of Eleanor wearing her lamb's wool jacket with a raised fist in front of Columbia University Law School. Most endearing is a page with portraits of both Ty as a very young child and Jeff in running gear. We learn about Eleanor quitting law school after participating in the Columbia University student takeover in 1968 and of Jeff joining SDS while a student at Antioch. There are other events that have been written about Weather Underground by Mark Rudd, Kathy Wilkerson, Bill Ayers, and others, but Ty Jones presents a different take, new insights, and of course, issues that still leave us with questions about the Weather Underground and the struggle in general. We learn a great deal about life underground, but for the purpose of this review, I would like to address one particular issue. It begins in early 1969 when Eleanor was part of a delegation that went to Cuba to meet with representatives of the National Liberation Front and the North Vietnamese government. Others on the trip included Bernadine Dorn and Diana Auten. The North Vietnamese had invited Eleanor and her comrades so that they could interact and learn how the anti-war movement in the United States might help to end the war. One of the first lessons was on the lack of focus of American activism. The teacher pointed out that day that anti-war slogans and chants, "No more Vietnams" versus "Too three many Vietnams," "No more wars" versus "Bring the war home," "Long live the victory of the people's war" versus "Make love not war," were contradictory. What was the goal? The Americans traveled Cuba with their Vietnamese mentors, and there were hours and hours of discussion. Eleanor and the other Americans became focused on taking one message to the masses at home: end the war now. When they returned to the U.S., however, they were informed that their leadership had decided to form small collectives. Their job was not to organize the masses. And I would argue that it was at this point, before the forming of the Weather Underground, before the townhouse bombing, before the manifestos and armed propaganda, before freeing and then being betrayed by Timothy Leary, and before the breakup of WUO, the youth movement for social justice and equality in the United States was doomed. That is, doomed as a movement. While the Vietnamese represented and spoke of a people's movement, people on the ground weren't included in the United States. People in the Weather Underground and the anti-war movement in general were young. We didn't take the lessons that others taught us. We didn't pay attention to how different Fidel and Che's revolution in Cuba was to Che's adventurous foray into Bolivia. We didn't know how to be part of a people's war. My analysis, of course, is only a small part of Ty Jones' book. And the people that he writes about, particularly his parents Eleanor Stein and Jeff Jones, as well as their Weather Underground comrades, have continued the fight to end class disparity and racism in the United States and throughout the world. Their mistakes, as well as their continuing commitment and passion, offer important lessons, as does Ty Jones' book, A Radical Line. This is Alan Weider for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Don is in the basement mixing up the medicine. I'm on the pavement thinking about the government. The man in a trench coat, batch out laid off, says he's got a bad cough, wants to get it paid off. Look out, kid, it's something you did. God knows when, but you're doing it again. You better duck down the alleyway, looking for a new friend. The man in a coonskin cap in a pig pen wants $11 bills. You only got 10. Maggie comes Fleetfoot, face full of black soot, talking at your heat, put plants in the bed, but the phone's tapped anyway. Maggie says the men say they must bust an early man. Orders from the DA. Look out, kid, don't matter what you did, but walk on your tiptoes, don't tie no bows. Better stay away from those that care out of fire hose. Keep a clean nose, wash the clean clothes. You don't need a weatherman to know which way the wind blows.
And that's Bob Dylan with the Subterranean Homesick Blues. Following up on Alan Weider's look back at a radical line from the labor movement to the Weather Underground, One Family Century of Conscience by Ty Jones. Thanks, Alan, for that. And that's going to be all from the Old Mole today. I've been your host, Clayton Morgridge, and our engineer is Joe Clement. Many thanks also to Bill Resnick and Charles Derber for their discussion of consumerism, to Mike Snedeker and Jan Hocken for their reflections on the legal status of whistleblowers, and Ivan Hale for reading Glenn Greenwald's piece about Bradley Manning and the Gay Pride Parade. Tune in to KBOO next Monday morning at 9 for more news, views, reviews, and interviews from the Old Mole's underground perspective. To hear this show or any part of it again, visit kboo.fm and type Old Mole Variety Hour in the search box, or become our friend on Facebook. Stay tuned now for an update on the elections in Iran.
Pride Northwest Incorporated is proud to announce its 2013 official Pride schedule of events for June 9th through 16th. We have a full week of exciting happenings designed to showcase and celebrate the LGBTQ community, including a Star Trek theme party, a special film screening, a comedy showcase, and a Tony Award-winning musical. The week will conclude with the 43rd annual Portland Pride Waterfront Festival and Parade, June 15th and 16th at Tom McCall Park. More information about the Portland Pride Festival and Parade can be found at